Welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring speeches, lectures, and sermons by international Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. Our program format today is a bit different from what is normally featured each week. Today you will hear from not only Ravi Zacharias, but also from another Christian apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig. In 1997, Ravi and Dr. Craig had the privilege of participating in a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa, where they were asked to respond to the top five questions that university students ask about Christianity. Today, Ravi and Dr. Craig answer the questions, how can we know that God exists? And how can a good God allow evil and suffering in the world? Many Christian believers struggle to answer these tough questions. Are there good reasons to believe that God exists, or is it more likely that there is no God? And what about the other question? Does it make sense that God is good and also allows evil and suffering? Well, let's hear what Ravi and Dr. Craig have to say on these issues as we continue this series of programs called The Top Five Questions.
Our second question, which will be initially addressed by Dr. Craig, is the question of the existence of God. How do we know that God exists? What reasons or evidence or arguments could a person put forward to make belief in God rational?
Back in the 1960s, the Death of God movement was current in American theology. On April 8th of 1966, Time magazine carried one of its most famous cover stories, in which the cover was completely black except for three words in red letters, "Is God dead?" And it described in that article the movement among American theologians to declare the death of God. Just a few short years after that death of God issue, Time magazine in 1967 carried another red on black cover story. Only this time the question read, "Is God coming back to life?" And it described the movement among contemporary American philosophers and intellectuals to rediscover the vitality of God. And indeed, I believe that in my own discipline of philosophy, there has been within this last half century literally a revolution in this respect. Several decades ago, it was widely believed among philosophers that talk about God was literally meaningless, just gibberish. And yet today, I think hardly any philosopher would defend such a point of view today. Instead, many of America's finest philosophers at our best universities are outspoken philosophers, or rather outspoken Christians, who are using philosophical argumentation in defense of a theistic worldview. Alvin Plantinga, who is certainly one of the greatest Christian philosophers writing today, gave a lecture a couple of years ago entitled Two Dozen or So Arguments for the Existence of God. And it was a dazzling lecture in which Plantinga carried his audience through more than two dozen different arguments that he believed makes it more plausible to believe that God exists than that atheism is true. Let me just share a couple of considerations with you this evening why I believe that on balance the evidence makes it more plausible that God exists than that he does not. Number one, I think that God makes sense of the origin of the universe. Have you ever looked out at the sky at night at the stars and asked yourself, where did it all come from? Why does anything at all exist? Why does matter and energy or space and time exist instead of just nothing? Well, typically atheists have said that the universe is just eternal and uncaused and that's all. But I think that discoveries in astronomy and astrophysics during this century have rendered that view less plausible. According to the best astrophysical evidence, the universe is not eternal, but began to exist in a cataclysmic explosion called the Big Bang about 15 billion years ago. Not only were all matter and energy, but physical space and time themselves were created in that event. And therefore, the Big Bang marks the creation of the universe out of nothing. There was literally nothing prior to that event. Now, that raises a profound metaphysical question. How can something come into existence out of nothing? Surely that is impossible. Out of nothing, nothing comes. That points to the existence of a transcendent cause beyond the universe, which brought the universe into being. And by the very nature of the case, this cause would have to be a being which transcends time and space, is therefore immaterial and changeless and enormously powerful. Already some of the central attributes of what the theist means by God. Moreover, I would argue, number two, that God makes sense out of the complex order in the universe. Scientists have been stunned by the discovery in the last 30 to 40 years that the initial conditions of the universe were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life with a complexity and delicacy that literally defies human comprehension. It's been shown that there are about 50 constants and physical quantities simply given in the Big Bang themselves, that if they were altered even to one part in 100 million, the universe would not have permitted the existence of life. And it's not just one of these or each one of these that needs to be fine-tuned, but the ratios between them need to be fine-tuned. The ratio between the weak force and the gravitational force has to be just a certain proportion in comparison to the ratio of the mass of the neutron to the electron, for example. And the odds against a life-permitting universe are literally incomprehensible. It seems to me that it makes far more sense to say that the universe is therefore the result of intelligent design. As Fred Hoyle, the Cambridge astronomer, says, a common sense approach to this would be to say that some super intellect has monkeyed with physics. In other words, we are not here by accident. We are here by design. And that means that this cause of the origin of the universe is not simply an impersonal cause or being, but rather a personal, intelligent creator who brought the universe into existence. Thirdly, I think that God makes sense out of objective moral values in the world. If God does not exist, then it seems to me that objective moral values do not exist. By objective moral values, I mean moral values which are valid whether anybody believes in them or not. For example, if the Nazis had won World War II, and either exterminated or brainwashed anybody who disagreed with them, anti-Semitism would still be objectively wrong, even if the Nazis had convinced everybody it was right. That's what I mean by objective values. And what I'm arguing is that if God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. Many theists and atheists alike agree on this point. The common evolutionary atheist will tell you that moral values are either just the byproducts of socio-biological evolution, the means by which the selfish gene propagates itself, or else they're simply expressions of personal taste, analogous to saying, I like broccoli, or I don't like the news. Similarly, someone will say, well, I like killing innocent people, or I don't like murder and rape. They're just expressions of personal preference. So that if God does not exist, I think it's plausible that there are no objective moral values, that these are just all subjective. Friedrich Nietzsche, the great atheist of the last century who proclaimed the death of God, understood that the death of God meant the advent of nihilism, that is to say, the destruction of all meaning and value in life. And I think that Friedrich Nietzsche was right. Now, we've got to be very careful here, though. I am not saying that you have to believe in God in order to live a good moral life. I'm not saying that at all. Nor am I saying that you have to believe in God in order to learn what good moral values are. I'm not arguing that either. Rather, what I am saying is that if there is no God, then there are no objective moral values. Moral values are just socio-biological byproducts of evolution or else expressions of personal taste. But it seems to me that there is simply no reason to deny that objective moral values do exist. I think deep down we all know that objective moral values exist. There's no more reason to deny the objective reality of moral values than the objective reality of the physical world. Some things, like torturing innocent people, child abuse, rape, and murder, are objectively wrong. Similarly, things like love, sacrifice, equality are objectively good. If an atheist says that he doesn't believe in God, well, then ask him, do you really think that the Inquisition was a good thing? That it's morally neutral to persecute people because of their religious beliefs and burn them at the stake? Were the Crusades morally neutral to wage war upon other people because they're of a different religion? I think people will intuitively recognize, if they're honest with you, yes, there are some things that are objectively right and objectively wrong. But if moral values cannot exist without God, and objective moral values do exist, then it follows logically and inescapably that God exists. Now, those are just three reasons that I think it's plausible to believe that a personal, intelligent creator who is the source of objective moral value exists. There are many more arguments that I could share, but my 10 minutes are up. Perhaps in the question and answer time, we could discuss some of these further.
Thank you, Bill. I really have very little to add to that, and so I will add very little. But I just want to point out one very interesting facet of the very question, does God exist? I think it was Dr. E. Stanley Jones, the famed English missionary who came to India and lived there for most of his life, right into his 80s, and became a very personal friend of Mahatma Gandhi and won the respect of Gandhi too. E. Stanley Jones made a very profound comment once. He said, people in the West spend their time wondering if there is a God, while the people in the East spend their time wondering which God to believe in. And I can just say this to you as one who has now lived in the West for a little over half of my life. I came to the West when I was 20, and America has now become home for me, where I treasure my residence, this is my home, this is where my children are being raised. I just want to make a very definitive statement here. The future of this entire nation hangs upon how they answer this question. Does God really exist? Because what Bill has said, the extensions from what he said about particularly the moral nature, the moral struggles with which we all live, this nation, right from its inception, struggled with reconciling liberty with law. How does one establish law if there is no longer even natural law that is accepted as having a point of reference? And so the issue of a transcendent being from whom our moral order and our moral law comes, I think, is a very significant one. Dallas Willard, professor of philosophy at University of Southern California, gives a three-stage argument. I think it's a very well-stated one, why he presents his reasons for the existence of God. Let me just read them for you as he's worded it, because if I were to start expanding on it, it'll just take me more time. He gives you three stages. Stage number one, however concrete reality is sectioned, the result will be a state of affairs which owes its being to something other than itself. However concrete reality is sectioned, the result will be a state of affairs which owes its being to something other than itself. That means every physical state has some specific time preceding it, and there whatever precedes that would have to be something that is non-physical if it is at the same time to be postulated as uncaused. Stage number two, this is an important step. He calls this not an argument from design, but an argument to design. Evolution, whether cosmic or biological, cannot logically be a theory of ultimate origins. Its operation presupposes the existence of certain entities with specific potential behaviors and an environment of some specific kind that operates upon those entities in some specifically ordered fashion. The type of structure found in evolution did not itself come through evolution. If you want to see an expansion of this, see Michael Behe's book, Darwin's black box, professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. I was with him 2 weekends ago, just a tremendous analysis as he is dealing with biochemistry and molecular biology to talk about the irreducible complexity which evolution itself cannot explain. So stage number one, that no matter how you section physical concrete reality, it has something outside of itself that needs its explanation. Stage number two, that the very starting point evolution cannot explain because the specified complexity is there. Stage number three, the course of human events, historical, social, and individual. So when we are talking about God as he exists, we are looking at a non-material, an intelligent, and a personal first cause. And when you look at these three stages, I believe there's a very persuasive argument made for why the God that we talk about as non-material, personal, and intelligent, the God of the Bible, does exist. Thank you.
The third question, which will be first addressed by Dr. Zacharias, is the problem of evil. How can the Christian God, who is claimed to be all good and all powerful, allow there to be evil in the world? And isn't there a contradiction implicit in claiming, on the one hand, that God is all powerful and all good, and on the other hand, claiming that evil exists?
I think of all questions, this may be the most difficult one to deal with. I have just finished responding to it in the latest book I have completed. The title of that is Cries of the Heart, and I have tried my best to approach this question from various angles, not just philosophical, which much has been written, but particularly the existential aspect of it. When you're looking for an answer to something as significant as this, let me just present to you three areas that I will look to in order to find satisfaction for myself. First, I stated these this afternoon, you're looking for logical consistency in whatever is presented. You're looking for empirical relevance here. You're looking for that which can be empirically tested. And certainly, you're looking for the existential relevance just as well, so that the logic of it, the empirical adequacy, and the experiential relevance, those three will be brought to bear upon the answer. Let me expand upon the question so that you can see its assumptions. It happened to me many years ago, in the early years when I was beginning to do such things as trying to defend the Christian faith in particularly hostile environments. And I was at the University of Nottingham in England when a student did not wait for me to even finish my talk. And he leaped out of his seat and he said, there cannot be a God when there is so much of evil, so much of gratuitous evil. He was obviously agitated by it. And I understood how he felt. One of the issues we'll be dealing with at some time, I remember walking through Auschwitz some years ago before the Cold War had thawed out. And I was asked to do some lectures in Warsaw and Poland. And my host, who was a medical doctor, asked me if I would like to go and visit Auschwitz before I left. I wasn't prepared for what I was going to see. I had seen Buchenwald in East Germany, but that was not a death camp. And it somehow did not stir up the same horror and the same unrest within you when you stood there. So I understood how this man felt. I understood fully the passion with which he felt it. There cannot be a God, he said, when there's so much evil, especially such gratuitous evil in this world. And I said, can we interact and can we do our best to talk about this without offending each other in the process, but dealing with this with importance because it is important to you, sir. It is important to me. I don't want to check my brains out at the door either. I want to have an answer to it just as well. I said, but help me understand where you're coming from. When you say there is such a thing as evil, aren't you assuming there is such a thing as good? He paused and he said, yes, I'm assuming that. I said, when you say there is such a thing as good, aren't you assuming there's such a thing as a moral law on the basis of which to differentiate between good and evil? If you remember the famous debate between the Jesuit philosopher Frederick Copleston and Bertrand Russell, at one point Copleston had Russell pinned on this question. And he said, Mr. Russell, do you believe in right and wrong? Do you believe in good and bad? And Bertrand Russell said, yes, I do. He said, how do you differentiate between good and bad? And Russell said, the same way I differentiate between yellow and blue. Copleson said, wait a minute, you differentiate between yellow and blue by seeing, don't you? He said, yes. How then do you differentiate between right and wrong, good and bad? Russell shrugged his shoulders and said, on the basis of feeling, what else? Now, you know, Copleson was a kind man and carried on the discussion, but somebody ought to have stopped and said, Mr. Russell, in some cultures they love their neighbors, in other cultures they eat them, both on the basis of feeling. Do you have any personal preference on the matter of feeling here? How can you decide such monumental issues of life on the basis of feeling, whether something feels right or feels wrong? So here it is. When you say that such a thing is evil, aren't you assuming that such a thing is good? Yes. When you say that such a thing is good, aren't you assuming that such a thing is a moral law on the basis of which to differentiate between good and evil? He says, I suppose so. I said, but when you assume that such a thing is a moral law, you must posit a moral law giver. But that's whom you're trying to disprove and not prove. Because if there's no moral law giver, there's no moral law. If there's no moral law, there is no good. If there is no good, there is no evil. He paused and looked at me and said, what then am I asking you? Now, I knew what he was asking me. He knew what he was asking me. He was basically saying, help me to make some sense out of this. Are you cheating me some way by this sleight of the hand logic that you have brought in here? No, I wasn't cheating him, but I was just trying to explain to him that the very framing of the question raises a philosophical dilemma for the questioner as much as it does for the one trying to answer it. How do we resolve this? So logically, the question only intensifies the dilemma because the questioner has to assume a capacity or a law by which to differentiate between good and evil. So this then moves us to the empirical adequacy part of it, and that is this. When we talk generally of the best of all possible worlds, philosophers have given us four possibilities. Would it not have been better for God to have created nothing rather than creating this kind of a world? No world at all. Number two, would it not have been better for God to have created a world where there was no such thing as good or evil, an amoral world? Number three, would it not have been better for God to have created a world where people would only choose good, a kind of a robotic world? Why did he create a world like this where there was the possibility of good and evil? As soon as you use the word better for God to have created the first three, once again you're invoking a moral law and an ability to decide what better would have been. C.S. Lewis points this out constantly. The moment you use the word better, you're assuming a way to measure what would have been morally better or superior. So why then this world? I think in this empirical adequacy slant to the question, I want to make this simple comment. Love is known in our experience to be the greatest of all ethics. Love is the supreme ethic. I don't think it was accidental that when somebody like Teresa was being buried in Calcutta, that Hindus, Muslim, Buddhist people from all over the world, including the atheist president of Albania, stood silently beside her corpse in recognition that a life had been beautifully lived and a life that had loved. It is the supreme ethic. So when they look at her will and look at the fact that nothing to her name, a life spent in love, the world of every perspective recognizes the supremacy of love. Love is only possible where the opposite is possible to reject love and to choose something contrary to it. So in the best of all possible worlds, if love is the supreme ethic, this is the world that makes it possible. In the logical case, the question can become self-defeating. In the empirical adequacy, love is made possible. In the experiential relevance, think of it this way now. If I were to take a life, just whimsically, it would obviously be something evil for me to do it, for the simple reason that I cannot restore that life. But if the author of life and the creator of life takes my life, has he really taken it when he also has the power to restore it to the very purpose for which this life was originally created, to enjoy that relationship with him and to glorify him?
That was Ravi Zacharias on the campus of the University of Iowa, answering the question, how can a good God allow evil and suffering?
Ravi will finish his answer to this question next week. For now, let's review Dr. Craig and Ravi's answer to the first question today. How do you know that God exists? Dr. Craig answered the question first, saying that only the existence of God makes sense of the origin of the universe, the order in the universe, and objective morals in the universe. Ravi added that atheistic philosophy cannot make sense of the personality we find in the universe. Only a personal creator could explain that. Please tune in next week for more answers to the top five questions. Today's broadcast, The Top Five Questions, is available through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as part of a two-tape album. The album features the complete responses of Dr. Zacharias and Dr. William Lane Craig to the top five questions asked by university students about Christianity. It also features an open session in which the speakers answer questions from the audience. When ordering, ask for tape number CA210, The Top Five Questions. That's CA210, The Top Five Questions. If you listen in the United States, place your credit card order by calling 1-800-448-6766. That's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. When you place your order, ask for your free copy of Ravi's newsletter, Just Thinking. The newsletter contains articles by Ravi and members of his ministry team that can be a helpful tool for understanding the issues of our day. To order online, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. There you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. The Online Resource Center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order resources. Once again, that's rzim.org. If you prefer to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. That's RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, contact our office there at 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. That's RZIM, 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. We at Ravi Zacharias International Ministries are also excited to tell you about a line of apologetic resources that we have available. We have partnered with respected authors in various fields to develop a line of booklets called the Critical Questions Booklet Series. To learn more about the booklets, call us at 1-800-448-6766 or visit us on the web at rzim.org. Please be sure to give us the call letters of the station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.